When Will We Ever Learn? That's a good song to begin my last environmental radio talk show, at least in this iteration. It's been 10 years since I started doing Eco Talk on the late and sometimes great Air America Network. That was the end of March 2004. I pitched the Progressive Radio Network, the first one of its kind, a green show, and they told me that, well, they already had one because Robert Kennedy Jr. would be mentioning the environment from time to time, to which I said, our embattled planet, don't you think it needs more than an occasional mention? And they said, okay, you can do a show, Betsy. And that began 3.5 rocky years, turbulent years at Air America. They had some great shows and great hosts and fabulous guests, but of course they did not know how to manage a network, and that's why they're no longer. So after that green show left me in the red, I took up internet radio production and hosting, and it's been a smoother ride, I would say. And that was first on Voice America, and for the last couple of years here on the Progressive Radio Network, I think it is just 2 years. And I want to thank the folks back there in the New York studios for making this show happen, mostly Gary Null and our board op Jessel and Jason Taubenfield. We're going to get on with a fabulous show today, but I just want to acknowledge, in case we run out of time at the very end, hoping my co-host D.R. Tucker can join us in progress. He does have a day job, and I've got to go look for one, because after all, internet radio is wonderful, but it doesn't pay, but at least they don't charge us to do these programs. And we are going to be talking about the debt that is accumulating, not only our fiscal debt and the fiscal cliff we've been teetering on, but also the climate debt and some of the ecological problems that we are leaving behind, the deficit, if you will, to the next generation. But we're gonna go right to the top and begin our show with the guy, along with Al Gore, who was first talking about climate change back there in the Congress in 1988, I believe. I am talking about none other than Dr. Jim Hansen, formerly the climate scientist at NASA, who left to go out on his own and be able to speak freely about this crisis. He is now with the Columbia Earth Institute and speaking wherever he can. And, Jim, thank you so much for honoring us with your presence and for joining us today.
Thanks very much for having me.
We've been following your progress and so glad that you're out there unfettered, unmuzzled. How has it been since you left NASA?
Well, as you imply, I'm very busy. Yeah, it's hard to choose which things to do. There's so many requests.
That's a good thing, I guess, isn't it? There's more and more interest, right?
Yeah, and I think we have to focus on the real fundamental things, and that, in the case of climate, means a carbon price. And I begun advocating several years ago the idea of a simple carbon fee across the board that you would collect from all the fossil fuel industry. There are actually only a small number of sources, so it's very easy to collect it at the mine or the port of entry. And then if we would distribute that money to the public on a per capita basis, then the person who does better than average in limiting their carbon footprint would make money. And that's really the only way we're going to get rapid reduction of fossil fuel use, if we make the fossil fuels pay their costs to society by putting a price on it. And it needs to be across the board, and it needs to be simple.
So you're talking about a price on carbon, otherwise known as a carbon tax, and that, of course, has been that effort been led by the Citizens Climate Lobby. I know how excited they were when you joined their cause, you being one of the key voices and names behind the effort to wake America up to smell the carbon, as we say on the program. Did that give you hope that there's actually a group out there and trying to be transpartisan in its efforts to convince our representatives that, as they say, to create the political will for a carbon tax?
Yeah, absolutely, because they are willing to stick to their guns. I met Marshall Saunders several years ago at the time, just after he had decided to form Citizens Climate Lobby, and persuaded him that it really needed to be a simple carbon fee rather than some hokey thing with cap and trade and with big banks involved with trading mechanisms and things.
That would be so confusing,
so
that citizens would not be able
to
understand it, and leaving it ripe for, taking advantage.
Yeah, and we have to, you know, so, of course, Democrats like this idea. After a few years, we've persuaded some Democrats. But then when they introduced a bill, they said, we want part of the money for, well, they say reducing the debt. But, of course, as soon as you're throwing the money into the general fund, then it's a tax. And that's not going to fly. And it's not going to work because the public will only support this if it's not a tax and if they get the benefit if they limit their carbon footprint. So I've actually been talking more to conservatives, even people like Grover Norquist, because we have to get this as a bipartisan effort. And I think that's possible. If we can just get enough of the public informed, because it, you know, it makes sense. And for the sake of our children, we had better get it understood pretty quickly.
And do you like to talk about it as a fee and dividend approach?
Yeah, that's what we call it, fee and dividend. It's, you know, it's not very sexy sounding, but it's not too hard to explain. There was, a fellow, Jim DePeso, who was the head of an organization called Republicans for the Environment.
Yes, he's been on our show.
And he said this can be explained in a one-minute elevator or two-minute elevator talk, and I think it can. And I think it's important that we keep it simple so the public can understand it.
Yeah, especially because people, the latest polls show that, you know, 52% of Americans still don't quite understand, you know, what climate change is or that it's really happening. It is kind of discouraging for those of us who live, you know, breathe and eat and drink it. But still there's, you know, a busy mainstream public that just has not quite tuned in to the enormity of this, although with ever-increasing, you know, dramatic extreme weather events, it seems that it's getting harder and harder to ignore.
Yeah, and it's going to be easier for them to see it in the next year or so because we are moving into the next El Nino, and that's going to make the planet warmer than it has been in the history of instrumental measurement. So that will happen by the El Nino is probably starting this summer, and it will affect especially next year's global temperatures. So the problem we've been having with several years being not showing much global warming, and that gives the contrarians a basis for continuing to deny reality, that's going to go away very soon.
Mm. And so is our stable climate if we don't get more people involved. What do you think the key is, and do you think there's a role for mainstream media in really informing the general public about the urgency and the complexity and the need for all of us to get on board, really?
Well, yeah, they've not done a very good job, actually, just because, well, for a number of reasons, but when it's always presented as he said, she said, and giving equal weight to science and to deniers, that it makes it difficult for the public to understand. But I'm glad to see, for example, AAAS just came out with a report which once again has said the science is clear. And the Academy, National Academy, has a report. So if the media would just pay attention to this and make clear that it's not equal sides, that the vast majority of scientists agree that humans are now the dominant factor causing climate change.
And, you know, mainstream media, news media in particular, CNN, they're very good at covering, you know, the really dramatic stories like this tragic plane going down. It's been pretty much wall-to-wall coverage. And yet, you know, it goes through its third week. It's, you know, hard to ignore the fact that, you know, in addition to a plane going down, our planet is going down, if that's not overstating it, and yet we have to fight for coverage that goes more than, you know, a couple of minutes. Yes, it's getting mentioned more by mainstream networks, but still not, you know, often enough, deep enough, and we've been advocating here on the program for a long time, probably ad nauseum, for a regularly, you know, occurring program like a talk show that we do, but with, you know, a much broader audience. These issues are so complex and they're so urgent that, you know, we do need more than a mention, don't we?
Yeah, it's, I mean, they're inherently difficult because of the decadal timescale of the changes, but at least now that the effects are becoming more apparent, I think there's a better chance to get action, and the window is rapidly closing, so it's really important what happens the next couple of years. So I wish you well in your new program. I hope you can be effective in getting a little more attention for this.
Well, thank you. We don't have a place yet, but I'm going to look, going to knock on a few more doors of media gatekeepers, you know, syndicators, programmers. You know, for years, every few years, I check in with them, and they say, an environmental program, a show on climate change? Who would listen to that? Who would watch that? Well, I guess we were just a little bit ahead of our time, as you were way ahead of your time, Jim. You know, I think if I call back soon, it'll be harder for them to make excuses, which were never all that solid to begin with, in terms of, you know, the American public not being interested. And, you know, perhaps they fear it would be, you know, boring or depressing, but there is so much, and that's, you know, why I've done some 1,200 interviews with experts like yourself who talk about what we need to do about this, what we can do about it, what is being done, and there is no place where that is, you know, happening in terms of reaching into, you know, Americans' living rooms and cars, you know, on, that's why I say, you know, sort of network or mainstream traditional broadcast outlets. While internet is fabulous, offering more access to both providers of content and listeners, it also, you know, is a more fractionated audience. You know, the audience gets kind of splintered. There's still, you know, masses of people who listen to the network. So that's where we're trying to go, and we'll see what happens. But let's go back a couple of weeks when tempers flared when you were back in Congress. You were at a Senate Foreign Relations Committee hearing along with Michael Bruin, who, by the way, will be our guest in the second half. So we have quite a show for you today. How did things heat up, and what was that like?
Well, I was just drawing attention to the fact that we understand very well that we cannot burn all of the carbon in the fossil fuel reservoirs, and yet governments are going right ahead and encouraging fossil fuel industry to go after everything they can find. It just doesn't make any sense. We're ignoring the implications of what we're doing for young people. We're going to leave them a situation that's out of their control if we don't begin to phase down emissions rapidly. And the only way that will happen is if we put a price on carbon. And, of course, the United States is now no longer the biggest emitter. China shot past us and is now almost double our emissions. So we will need to work with China and the developing countries if we're going to solve this problem. And we have an obligation to do that. And that was what I was pointing out, that we burned our share of the carbon budget, and then we started burning the share of the developing world. So there's very little budget left now. And they have every right to develop and improve their standard of living, but we can't let they can't use fossil fuels to do that, or we all go down together. We're all on the same boat together. So we have an obligation to work with China now, and India and other countries as they're beginning to develop, and we're just not paying attention to that obligation.
Could not agree with you more, and you are a father and a grandfather, and yet you were willing to be arrested at the Keystone Pipeline protest outside the White House, and perhaps another time or two, and that's, I guess, was the focus of the hearing. Why is this question of whether to extend, you know, and finish building this pipeline, put it into operation fully, something that, as you famously have said, would be game over for the climate. Do you still believe that?
Well, what I meant by that, and as I explained to the Senate, was that's opening the door to the unconventional fossil fuels in a big way. Mm-hmm. And it just doesn't make sense. Because if we look at how much carbon there is in conventional oil and gas and in coal and the unconventional fossil fuels, what we quickly see is that conventional oil and gas is essentially going to burn up our allowable carbon budget. So the only way we can solve the problem is by phasing out coal, which would is used mainly for generating electricity, and leaving the unconventional fossil fuels in the ground. That's why it does not make sense to set up a pipeline which would guarantee that Canada would exploit a large part of the tar sands oil. As soon as we put any reasonable price on carbon, then tar sands oil will become uneconomic. It takes a lot of energy to get that out of the ground and then do the preliminary processing. It's very dirty stuff and very expensive. So as soon as we get a price on carbon, that no longer makes sense. So we shouldn't spend billions of dollars setting up that infrastructure. And that's what lawmakers are just ignoring, just these fundamental facts that it makes no sense, particularly for young people.
And speaking of lawmakers, were you impressed, as I was, with the recent overnight Wake Up for Climate all-nighter that Sheldon Whitehouse spearheaded along with Barbara Boxer and Brian Schatz of Hawaii? Too bad it was the middle of the night, and there were maybe, I don't know, 15, 20 people testifying, you know, one at a time over 15 hours. But it was still good to hear that, you know, quite a few of them, or in particular several of them, really get it. Bernie Sanders.
Well, I guess I was less impressed than you were. I don't know if they're trying to maintain their support from environmentalists, but what we really need is some action that addresses the need for a fee on carbon. And I think that, you know, from talks with some conservatives, I think that if we don't use that as a source of money for making the government bigger, I think we can persuade, hello, are you still there?
Yes, we hear you fine.
Yeah, I think that we can, so I would rather see some action rather than just words.
Absolutely agree with you, Jim. I just, I was imagining if there were, you know, people like those of us who stayed up late to watch it, you know, if the mass public was really tuning in, and of course they weren't.
Yeah, it's just that we're too small in number.
We've got to
reach the mainstream people.
Here, 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 and that's exactly what I'm setting off to do again, because really we won't have a tipping point fast enough to make a difference, will we, unless we really do, you know, penetrate mainstream consciousness. And
right.
Did you ever dream in a million years back then when you were testifying with Al Gore that not only would denial play such a role in this, you know, psychological, sociological denial, let alone what the Koch brothers and fossil fuel industry have funded to fuel the complacency or the, you know, quote, confusion over whether the climate crisis is real?
No, I was way too naive. I thought that since governments did address the ozone problem and the acid rain problem, I thought they would address the climate problem. But in fact, it's only been words from governments. There's been no substantial action, and that I would not have guessed that 25 years ago, but unfortunately, that's the way it's gone.
And with each day, you know, lost being a precious loss in this fight, do you get angry? And how do you sleep at night? Maybe share some, you know, fatherly advice, grandfatherly advice for some of us who are, you know, really upset about this, the lack of progress, since even if we all got on board, it's still, you know, the monster of all challenges. And, of course, climate change impacts so many other environmental issues, ocean acidity, biodiversity, crops, you know, drought. I was happily awakened in the middle of the night. We had pounding rain in California. We've been in the middle of a long drought, and so it was welcome. Sun's out again now. But, you know, every part of the country has felt, you know, extreme weather, and it's already here. And even if we got off carbon tomorrow, which, of course, we won't, you know, it's still locked into the atmosphere, as you have taught us all, for the next 50 or so years. So I think that's where the impatience and anger, you know, has to come from.
Yeah.
We have
and
so
to answer
little
your question
underway.
About sleeping, in fact, I do have trouble sleeping because, you know, I think we have not communicated this. I mean, obviously, the communication has failed, and there are a lot of excuses for why that is the case, but it is also partly, you know, scientists are not very good communicators, and I naively thought that I could write this book I wrote, Storms of My Grandchildren, and I thought, okay, I'm going to make this story clear. Well, in fact, I didn't. I mean, it was too technical a book, so I'm trying again. And that's one reason why I'm so busy, because I'm still trying to do science. I'm also going to meetings and trials, and have several lawsuits going. But I also want to write a book which will be clearer than my first one. So I'm starting to write Sophie's Planet, which consists of letters to my oldest grandchild. And I think I can do a better job with this second book than I did with the first one.
Well, I'm glad you're working on that, Jim, but don't be too hard on yourself, because after all, Al Gore did a movie that really clearly depicted what we're up against, and that was 8 years ago. And while it did serve to wake up a lot of people, you know, and many of us would have bet that would be the turning point, it wasn't. It still wasn't. So what is it going to take, do you think?
Well, see, in case of Al's movie, he didn't really give the solution. You know, I talked about changing light bulbs and changing your habits and things, but those are nice to do. But what we really need is this rising carbon fee. And so that's why I'm supporting very strongly the Citizens Climate Lobby. Mm-hmm. And we have to get that understood, that otherwise we're going to stay addicted to fossil fuels, and our governments are just allowing and encouraging fossil fuel industry to go after everything they can find, even though science has now made it clear we can't do that.
Mm. I remember, Jim, you'll appreciate this, back in Nashville probably about 5 years ago, I was on my third or fourth trip to, you know, I'm one of the volunteers that Al Gore trained, and he was bringing us back for updates, or we were bringing ourselves back for updates. And it was 2 or 3 weeks after this, you know, record flooding in Nashville, and the hall that we were holding this event in had just 2 weeks before 6 feet of water in it, you know, epic flooding in Nashville. And I was standing outside of that hall waiting for a cab to go back to the hotel when someone introduced me to Marshall Saunders, and he was talking about, you know, what he was starting with Citizens Climate Lobby. And I said, you ought to go in there and talk to Al Gore about this. I think this is the most encouraging thing I've heard. And, of course, he went on to do just that. And, of course, Mark Reynolds, who was a fabulous spokesman for the cause, has taken over very ably. And I was able to attend last June their conference in D.C. And I really do think it's the most encouraging organization out there, because they're so passionate, tireless, bipartisan or transpartisan. And, you know, really, there is such a need to create the political climate for this kind of tax. It really feels like that's all that will get us out of this, or maybe start to turn the ship.
Yeah, our democratic system has a lot of flaws, where money has started to play a bigger role than citizens. But the democratic system can still work. And that's what Citizens Climate Lobby is trying to do to use that system. And they're very patient. They visit congresspeople, and if they don't get a good reception, they're still very polite, and they come back
positive.
Again.
Very positive, and that is a great approach. We have D.R. Tucker joining us now. He just stepped out of a meeting at his other job, and D.R., welcome to the show, the last one, and very pleased to have Jim Hansen on. Thank you for arranging it, D.R. And, Jim, I think you said D.R. was last on my program, and it was EcoTalk on Air America back in 2006, 8 years ago. We've come a long way, and yet not nearly far enough.
I guess it's just wanted to say thanks both to you, Dr. Hansen, for all of your great work, and thanks to you, Betsy, for all of your great work as well. And just wanted to mark this end of an era and the beginning of hopefully another one, just to, you know, to just to look back at all the great work that you have done, and just to sort of, you know, say thank you again for your tireless efforts, and as well as to you, Dr. Hansen, for your tireless efforts. And, you know, maybe it's the first day of the rest of our lives, so to speak.
And I don't know,
the turning point of finally getting this this crisis resolved once and for all.
And DR and I met, by the way, when I was on Hannity a couple of years ago, and I quoted DR Tucker as having been a former Republican and climate skeptic who actually read the IPCC report and, you know, woke up and smelled the carbon, so to speak, and he has become a passionate activist, tireless, even more so than I. He's awake at 4 in the morning trolling the Internet for anything to do with climate change and energy issues, and sends it out to a small email list who also can't sleep enough because of this crisis. So that's a compelling story, isn't it, Dr. Hansen? I should call you, not Jim, sorry, but I followed you so long, I feel like I know you.
Well, no, you should. Everybody calls me Jim. That's fine.
Thank you.
That's we need more people like that, and I think we are getting more. I find that when I give talks, and there are a lot of people in the audience who want to know what they can do, and I mention these organizations, especially Citizens Climate Lobby, also Our Children's Trust and Bill McKibben's 350.org. And those organizations are growing. So I think we're going to get there. We just need to do it as soon as possible.
Mm-hmm. Like yesterday. In fact, we invited Bill McKibben back on the show. He regretted that he would be on a plane. He said it always seems to be on an airplane. I know he has mixed feelings about flying all over the globe speaking on climate change, as I'm sure Al Gore did or still does. But he sent his regards and thanked us for doing this show for a long time. And those of us who have been in the trenches in different areas, you at the top of the scientific community, me trying to, you know, break some ground in mainstream media and bring more green content and consciousness to it. You know, you get to a point, don't you, where you know too much, and even if you'd like to call it quits and just go back to the real world concerns, we can't. You know, it goes beyond, you know, a job or, you know, professional expertise, doesn't it?
Well, Bill has said, you know, well, at least we know we're working on something that's really important. So I don't mind working 80 hours a week, knowing how important it is.
There could not be a more noble cause, for sure, and that is what keeps us going, I'm suspecting. And again, knowing too much, how do you not? But it's time for mainstream media to really cover this like the, you know, gargantuan issue it is, and that's what I'm going to try to make happen again. But I think there might be more receptivity about now. But, DR, it's your turn. We just have a couple minutes left. Any questions you want to cover?
Well, just an observation with regard to what you noted in terms of mainstream media attention, also the policy responses to the climate crisis. There's this line that's been attributed to the writer Victor Hugo, that nothing, not all the armies in the world, can stop an idea whose time has come. And I think that if Victor Hugo was around today, he'd say the same thing. Even if you're facing an army of money, an army of, you know, propaganda and disinformation, that, you know, truth always has a way of winning out, even when it doesn't seem like that's the case. And I think that ultimately truth is going to win out here. And both you, Dr. Hansen, and both you, Betsy, will be vindicated as the heroes of history for staying with this fight.
Oh, my. Thank you, Darren. You too. You're in it, too, for better or worse, right? And speaking of media and the power of media to transform minds and wake people up, I'm sure you saw Chasing Ice, Jim, and you probably also saw the short video of the woman who went in there who was a Bill O'Reilly Fox diehard fan, went in there to, quote, laugh about global warming and came out in tears, saying that she had no idea it was real and she was going to go home and call all her friends, many of whom she had argued with in her own house and had kicked out of her house because they didn't agree that climate change was a hoax. You know, that really reinforces the power, you know, to really mobilize the masses if used properly. And I'm sure you both agree, what better use of mass media outlets, be it, you know, network news or, you know, movies, documentaries, to really awaken the masses.
Yeah, and I think that, as I mentioned earlier, we do need to get conservatives to understand the issue because, you know, on the long, over long time scales, conservatives have actually been friends of the environment. They just misinterpret this as being a threat to their freedom. And in fact, it doesn't need to be if we address the problem properly. With a fee on carbon, it will actually be consistent with conservative principles, where we're letting the market decide what the solution should be, rather than imposing them from the government.
And to that, I would say that I do wish that some of our friends, current and former, in my case, all former on the right, would realize that. One cannot be free and submerged at the same time.
Well said, as always. Okay, we just have about 2 minutes left, Jim. I just want to give you a chance to say what you would like to see happen next, if you could wave a magic green wand, so that we can really leapfrog over some of the, you know, impasses that we've been stuck at, be it in Congress, mainstream public, you know, tuning in. What needs to happen next for us to feel like we're turning the corner and have any hope for making a difference in time?
Well, I sound like a broken record, I realize, but it also is true that you have to keep repeating things. And that is, we need to get people to understand that as long as fossil fuels are allowed to be the cheapest energy, and that's only because they don't pay their costs. So we need to, for the benefit of everything, especially including the economy, our economic well-being, economies work best if costs are honest. And so we shouldn't be subsidizing fossil fuels by not making them pay their costs. So we have to get people to understand that it will make sense to put a price on carbon. And if the money is returned to the public, most people will be better off.
Mm. And do you think that we really do need to do a better job of connecting the dots, even though we cannot, you know, tie any one weather event to, you know, climate change impact? We have certainly seen dangerous, frightening trends across the board, you name it. Droughts, fires, you know, rain where it shouldn't be or too much rain, flooding. You know, epic hurricanes, even though there may not be as many one year or the next, they're certainly more devastating. We keep seeing it now. This mudslide could be, you know, function of all the excess rain they've had. Is that a way to really get people to tune in because it does impact them where they live and their loved ones and their livelihoods?
Well, we do certainly have to connect all the dots, and we have to be careful to do it in a way where it's scientifically justified. But in fact, it is clear that extreme events, both in temperature and in precipitation, are increased by in a warming world. And therefore, it's legitimate to remind people that the increasing extremities that we see, 100-year floods occurring much more often than once a century, are, in fact, related to the changing climate.
Tiara, I'll let you have the last question for Jim, since we're just about out of time, but you joined us in progress, so have at it.
Well, not so much a question, but just an observation that it's going to be very, very interesting to see how this issue manifests itself in the 2014 midterms and definitely the 2016 presidential campaign. Something tells me that Mother Nature is going to get the first vote, so to speak, and once that vote is cast, it's going to be very, very hard for certain people to get away with downplaying or denying the need to take action.
I'm sure you agree, Jim. And also, just one last, I keep saying last, but got to ask you, do you think that the Tea Party getting 30 members in Congress in 2010, was it, midterm elections, really hurt our cause, our effort to really make this issue of utmost importance, and it got politicized and co-opted because of that extreme conservative element there, denying it?
Well, the denial has, of course, not helped. But as I've also said, I think that thoughtful conservatives are beginning to understand the implications of denial, and that is that when Mother Nature makes it obvious that it's not a hoax, then it's going to result in the public demanding actions, and that becomes the worst nightmare of conservatives, because then it will be government-imposed actions, while it would make more sense to do what I've described, putting a price on carbon and letting the market work rather than government-imposed policies.
Mm. We just got word that Michael Bruin is a few minutes behind, so can we just keep you another couple of minutes? Jim, really appreciate your hanging in with us.
Sure. More.
Okay. I just wanted to ask you, what was it like being arrested and being in prison and being out there with, I think, 1,200 others was the largest protest, and then there was another large one, was it over the summer in D.C.? Did it feel like, you know, finally, as Al Gore said, when 1,000 volunteers showed up in Nashville to learn his slideshow presentation, the cavalry has arrived?
Well, it is encouraging in the sense that if we go back of a few years, the numbers were much smaller. There's still not enough to really force the hand of the politicians, but they're not ignored anymore.
Mm-hmm. Good point.
And I think there is a much larger fraction of the public that is now ready to get involved. So I think that things will change over the next few years, and we just have to make it as soon as possible.
Mm-hmm. And I think having, you know, someone your age, with all due respect, and Bill McKibben even being a little older than your average, you know, protester at, you know, other types of demonstrations, really does make a difference. You know, I think you were arrested with, you know, your suit and tie on, and, you know, why is this NASA climate scientist willing to go to jail? Those are the kind of stories the media do pick up on, sort of not your stereotypical protester.
Yeah, although they could do a better job. You know, there were cases where there were 1,000 or hundreds of protesters around the White House, and the media not giving it as much attention as I think it deserved.
Mm. You know, having been inside mainstream media for 20 years, I worked for CBS Radio, I think it's partly ignorance, although they're starting to, you know, connect the dots, but too little too late for sure. And that's why they should hire some of us who actually know how to speak the language and know the key players, but that's another story. I think it's partly ignorance and partly because it has been co-opted, it's been politicized and polarized and propagandized, it being climate change and all the other, you know, big environmental challenges we face, they feel like they can't touch it because it's controversial, or they do feel the need to, you know, get both sides on. And that has just been a huge disservice, and hopefully we're getting past that, you know, impediment, you know, to say, yeah, it's been, you know, taken out of context to be, you know, appearing as a political issue when it's really the most practical matter we could even discuss.
Yeah, that's the difficulty, that the fossil fuel industry has been successful in making it a political issue. While, in fact, protecting the rights of young people is not really political. It shouldn't be.
And the unborn. Yeah. You know, it's such a short time frame that this is happening in, and you know, when just in the last 19 years since my daughter was born, you know how much worse things have become, even faster than what we say climate scientists, you, Dr. Jim Hansen, had predicted. We just don't have time to spare, and we are just about out of time for sure, for real. But I can't let you go without asking what you think about fracking.
Well, see, that's is another unfortunate way. The fossil fuel industry has invested enormous amount of money over the last decade or two in drilling technologies, and they've been very successful. But as long as the government allows fossil fuels to not pay their costs, then they're going to continue to find ways to get more out of the ground. And it becomes more and more difficult, and therefore the damage becomes greater. And that's what we need to change, and that's what could be changed even with a moderate rising price on carbon, because then the clean alternatives would, in fact, be competitive, and we would reach tipping points where clean energy alternatives would begin to cause the fossil fuels to be phased out. But until we get that price, it's fossil fuel companies will continue to go after everything they can find.
So I guess we can say a rising carbon tax will lift all carbon boats or something like that.
Or sink all the carbon boats.
Right. Speaking of rising seas. Well, we want to thank you so much for all your dedication. So glad you're still going strong. I wish you some sleep at night. And we need you around for a long time. And we're so glad you are able to speak out freely. You are the most important person out there, along with, of course, Al Gore and Bill McKibben, and you we trust. So thank you for all your great work.
Thanks for having me on. And I hope you're successful in getting a really good follow-up to this program, which has been great. Thanks very much.
Thank you. From your mouth to the green goddess's ears, we're going to take a quick break and come back, I hope, with Michael Bruhn, who is the very bold, very brave, very outspoken executive director of the Sierra Club. We'll be right back.